when we look at change in our lives, we can look at change in relation to the structure of our life, which is what the work of Daniel Levinson was really measuring, is that there's these life structures that are age appropriate, that certain kinds of decisions and certain transitions tend to happen according to a general pattern for human development, and that pattern is somewhat affected by the age of the particular time of in humanity that this is going on, and some of it tends to be more of a longer period of time. C.G. Jung was in modern times one of the first to talk about this kind of change, and when he talked about the first half of life is about establishing your outer life, and then the second half of life is about resolving your inner life. And he said that the second half of life could begin at 35, which it did for me, or it could begin at 65. People took a long time sometimes getting to some of these issues. In my own experience of working with people, it's pretty rare that they haven't had the inner life start calling them in some way long before 65. They've just overridden it. There's been all sorts of messages that they've overridden. It wasn't that they just didn't know to listen, or they were afraid to listen, or didn't know how to listen, and so forth. I'm having to edit everything down for our purposes here today, so it's a little different than my usual way of doing this. In Levinson's work, he postulates that there are eras in our life, and then there are transitions within those eras. So he says that there are three large eras of adult life. There is the early adulthood era. Before that, there's a childhood era. So then there's an early adulthood era, which he says goes on to the age of 40. It, certainly, when you think about a lot of people you know, you go, yeah, some people are very... That's a little encouraging for some of my friends. They may have missed a transition or two in there, though. We'll come back to that. And so he says that this goes on to 40, that the culminating life structures of early adulthood, the last of those occur between 33 and 40, which when you think about, it's so easy in terms of women to see this because of having to do with birthing and all that but even with males, this shows up in all these different ways. Then the second era is the era of middle adulthood, that between 40 and 65, we're in middle adulthood. So I just turned 65, so I would be at the end of that and would be starting the era of late adulthood. Now, we all have heard these things that, that 50 is the new 40 and 60 is the new 50. And I heard one not too long ago that 60 was the new 40. Boy, they have a different experience in their body than I do in mine. How a particular time looks will change, but these changes are I've now done thousands of interviews with people, so I have a rather large database, and I essentially agree with Levinson, although I don't now his works you know, somewhat dated now. I think we have had the needle move back a little, in some ways, so that in some instances we're talking about everything's getting prolonged, including when early adulthood really starts and how long early adulthood that era goes. It's everything's getting more drawn out in our society, and many, many people have made this reference in lots of different ways. But I don't want to get into that kind of splitting hairs, because essentially, since I'm the one you've invited to teach, I accept this premise that there is an era of early adulthood, of middle adulthood, and late adulthood. And that in each of those big eras, there are two parts. There is the entry level structure of a life in each of these, and then the culminating life structure in each of these. So there's two periods within this of each of these eras. And the reason I bring this up is what's in Levinson's work. I'm certainly wanting to give credit and all that, but also because it means that in each of our time periods we're in, we have a transition. So here you are in your middle adulthood years. You're somewhere between 40 and 60 in your middle adulthood. And so say you're 45, and you have gotten. You've made your transition, so you've got a life structured in some way. So that goes on for a while. But then somewhere in there, and he says between the ages of 50 and 55, you go through another transition. You're for various reasons, you change the structure of your life. It can be because of anything from hormones to something to do with your work. You change in some way, so you create a different structure. What's reassuring about that is we can feel as though there's something wrong with us because we're wanting to change the structure of our life in some way, or that we're never satisfied, we're never right. But it's actually just the Buddhist principle of anicca, that of course things are changing, and they're changing underneath all the time. And then at some point, they coalesce, they accumulate to the point that we enter another transition in our life. So just to take you through the numbers of this, some of you are taking notes. So in his research, the era of early adulthood is between 17 and 45, and the transition period out of pre-adulthood is between 17 and 22 of that. So we transition out of our pre-adulthood between those years. I was really convinced that I was going to feel like a man at 21 because I had been so mature my whole life. And I'd had lots of adult-like responsibilities, really starting from the age of 7. I know that sounds like some sort of a large statement, but if I told you the facts of my circumstances, it would make sense to you. And there's been studies of lots of... there's this famous Lebanon study where the kids that were orphans living on the street, they had their own version of... having to be grown up really early, and they studied what happened to them and why some people prospered and some didn't. Quite interesting. So I thought at 21 I was going to feel like a man, that I would be complete, and I wasn't, and I was just very disappointed. And then I said, well, okay, I got this wrong. So it's 25 when you feel like that, you know. And I went around and asked my friends, they'd all kind of like, what are you talking about? And so then as I started approaching age 25, now I had huge responsibility, you know, as a young adult in all these different ways. And at 25, I didn't feel like a man. I didn't feel like this is, you know, I'm now. There was something that wasn't okay feeling. Something wasn't okay. I didn't know that I was having just a normal transition. It felt like a big inadequacy to me. And I sort of thought, well, okay, this isn't how I thought that the inner feeling matured is just off. I must be off in this, and it's not going to happen that way. And then at age 28, out of nowhere, I wasn't doing anything any different. Suddenly, there was a new inner configuration happened to me. And I went around telling my friends, oh, it's so great. And they're like, what? they had no sensitivity to this within themselves. They just weren't oriented that way. But I was extremely oriented to this kind of inner felt sense all my life. So it was very important to me, these kinds of transitions. So the early adult transition, getting out of being a kid, he says it's a 17 to 22. At 22, we enter our first life structure of early adulthood. And he says this is a six-year period of creating this structure. Now, how this structure looks varies dramatically based on everything from your parents to your education to whatever. But it's an early life structure, early adulthood life structure. And then sometime between 28 and 33, you go through a transition as a early adult, as a young adult. You go through a transition, and this is this 30 thing, right? The turning 30 that everyone makes the thing about. But that somewhere in there, something does change. And for most people in our society, it seems to me towards the back end of that time period. But that there is a transition between 28 and 33, and it is a more established kind of life structure that you start to have. That's age appropriate. Once again, you have found your way enough to, you know more of what you're about. You can make better decisions for yourself. You more line up with yourself. If you're fortunate, doesn't always happen. And so that you then have this life structure that as a young adult, as an early adult, in early adulthood, that he says goes on until 40, and that there is this this period of a kind of stability between 33 and 40 in terms of the structure. And then at age 40, this again, these are just big, broad categories. He wouldn't mean it so specifically. But between 40 and 45, there's another midlife, there's a transition. Yes?
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it would help me enormously. You gave an example of a life structure.
A life structure would be your job, relationship, where you live, the kind of housing you have, the way you're structuring your time, all of the structures of your life. I'm going to stop this and answer that more completely because this was my second part of this. One thing that that I was, when I first encountered this research, was heartening to me is that he, as do I, makes a distinction between a life crisis and a structure. So we all know about the midlife crisis, right? That people have. You can have a midlife crisis at any age. That crisis can come from external reasons. That is, that your circumstances change so much that you're in a crisis about it. Who are you going to be? How are you going to do this? That affects your life structure like crazy. But it wasn't that the life structure, you weren't trying to change the life structure. Suddenly you don't have a job anymore. Your income prospects are so different, or your health prospects are so different, or there's some sort of a crisis that, you know, all sorts of things can come up that you finally admit, you know, that you're gay and you've been denying to yourself you were gay your whole life. So that's a crisis. The life structure that you've created doesn't necessarily support what has now happened. So we can have crises come at any point. You're in an accident, a car accident. You know, I start to say you win the lottery, but in a way that wouldn't really count in the same way because that doesn't seem to make any difference. And ironically, all this research is showing. So but there's crisis. I then take yet a third I take a third one of these. These changes and transitions, which I refer to as a lifestyle change, which can come about because of a value change. So you didn't have a crisis. It wasn't age-based. It wasn't that your maturation process of the arc of your life. You had a values change. That's what happened to me, is that I had, you could say I found my true values, what was most important to me, or that they matured or whatever it was. But I changed my life dramatically, but because of an inner thing that was not, I was not in crisis. I was doing quite well, thank you very much. And I was actually enjoying what I did, but it wasn't right. And that was what was so confusing to me. And some of you are in those situations. It just wasn't right for me, even though it was stimulating. Even though I loved the challenge of it, and the business part was a drag, but the creativity part was fun. But the total effect wasn't... I said during the Q&A, first Q&A period, it wasn't ringing my bell. There wasn't this deep resonance of that this was a life that I wanted my life to be defined this way. So these three kinds of things can happen. So as in the early stage, you're finding who you are in the world, finding who you want to be with. You settle down with someone somewhere in the 30s, maybe. It's gotten later and later for men, particularly, but for women too, but really late for a lot of men. And then by the time you turn 40, you're ready to be a full grown up. You know, you're in your middle years. Your life structure. You know your capabilities in a way that you didn't when you were starting out. You, in many instances, have created your bona fides, your credentials for doing what you want to do. You know how to maneuver the world. How to interact with the world and everything from buying a house or evaluating where you want to live to negotiating something with your job. You've had the life arc has had the experiences so that you can say, okay, this is what I really want to do. This is what I really want to be. And for a lot of people, those are the years between 40 and 60 that the primary thing for me is raising my children. And that's very and our culture, those are really prime years for that. And the life structure is built around the kids, right? And many of you have had that kind of a life structure. The second life structure that it's built around is our career and our society. And the third may be that there's some place that you want to live. There's so you want to be in a community like Seattle or San Francisco or something like this, and you will give up, you will limit your income or you will limit your ability to save because you want this is there. There's an environment that's part of your structure that's so important to you to be with your tribe or like-minded people. Your identity is, let's see how to ask more questions.
The example you gave of value to me is an identity. You know, you said that was different, and that's to me.
Well,
experience that as an identity issue.
Well, your identity is being formed as part of the life structure. And if you have a crisis, your identity is threatened in some way. When I was talking about a lifestyle change, the way I'm making this third categorization, which he's not doing, I didn't have a different identity. It was not an identity crisis. I was then and am now a person who feels capable in relation to the world. So I didn't have a different, it was not a different identity. It was that what I do with my time was what changed. It became very important to me that my time, that my life be about something other than my capabilities. And my identity didn't change as an inner experience for me. It may not work for you as a structure, and you may prefer just to have the two, that there's either your life structure, which includes your identity, as the way you're saying it, and that. So for you to classify what I'm talking about and my change as part of a life structure, that's fine. So I don't want you to get hung up on the structure in this way, but to understand that that in Nietzsche, there's a life arc in our society, and it tends to break down in these eras, and that there tends to be within each era two phases of it. And those two phases matter because you may be in one of those phases and be a little disoriented because you were in the first phase and now you're in the second. You like the first one better, but it's no longer appropriate for you. It's just the life arc has moved you on. Is this making sense to you? So, this midlife transition between 40 and 45 is another one that I think is moving. We are later and later moving into that period of great confidence. The middle adulthood years are the years of greatest productivity for most people because you know more of who you are and you've learned how to do what you do. Not true necessarily for like mathematicians, which tend to have all of their stuff there. The ones who invent the new formulas, they tend to do that very early. You know, I mean, there's exceptions, but their role, they even though they may have done their brilliant work, they've got the power in terms of the structure of our society, the structure of the people who tend to have the power in our society in general, the middle manager doers of it tends to be people in this 40 to 65 age group. And as we are in this period of time, that whatever time we fill ourselves in, there's going to be all sorts of changes coming up, so that we orient towards change as being the norm rather than being the exception, and we don't think we've done something wrong if we are suddenly feeling a change happening to us or needing to change and so forth. Coming back to this. When we bring the Dharma into play in terms of the regular life that we're all having, people have never heard of Dharma, everybody has a life arc. We all know this. When we bring the Dharma into play in this, we have certain tools that we can utilize that help us in our changes and transitions. One of those is mindfulness itself. Because through the mindfulness, we are able to be present for what's happening, and that gives us much more chance to interact, to co-create something that's happening in our lives. Without the mindfulness, we're going to have a lot less possibility of that. I said last night that I've taken more and more to talking about compassionate mindfulness, because if we're not compassionate towards ourselves, or compassionate towards someone who's going through a change, or compassionate towards someone who's having to put up with our change, then we are more likely to be unskillful. We're more likely to get closed down in some way, or to not be able to stay present. Because it's to stay present for the difficulty of and the uncertainty of a change is challenging. And therefore, we tend, the average mind just averts. It moves away. It distracts itself in some way. It entertains itself. It creates some acting out process rather than living through the change mindfully. So we have the metta and the compassion, the sympathetic joy, and the equanimity of the Brahma Viharas. With mindfulness, this compassionate mindfulness, in our practice, we have developed equanimity of varying degrees. We have learned self-comfort. Self-comfort that calms us, that calms the mind, which is a separate awakening factor. There's 7 awakening factors. Self-comfort is separate from equanimity. This is not a weekend about the 7 awakening factors. Equanimity as calm, this posada, this tranquility of mind. We know when the mind is calm. Equanimity is when the mind is balanced. So when the mind is balanced, if it gets knocked over in some direction, it comes back into balance. If it gets pulled forward, it regains its balance as it's going forward. If it's knocked back on its heels, it comes. It's like that. They used to have that doll thing that would always come back up. That's a kind of simplified version of equanimity. That we stay in balance. So you've heard probably on some Dharma talk at one time or another about that with our mindfulness we're like the surfer riding the waves. We're able to stay with the ups and downs of life. That's equanimity, that ability to surf our own life experience. In our practice, we also cultivate insight. So we become aware of the hindrances of mind as they are occurring around a change and transition. So all these practices that you already know. So you know when your mind is filled with a kind of wanting, with greed, or with aversion, or that there's sloth and torpor, or there's restlessness and worry, or there's doubt. You know all of these hindrances of mind. You've sat on retreats or daylongs, or Rodney's lectured you about these things. And that becomes very useful in a change and a situation, because you're able to not get so caught in where you could be completely lost, not get lost, or be lost for less time, and not there so you didn't make a wrong decision that you would have made, or you're able to make a decision sooner, and so forth. And your ease of your life is so much stronger because you recognize the hindrances just as mind states. They're just hindrances of mind. They're not something more. They're not a you. You are not the one who is doubting. Doubting is arising within this knowing. But it's just doubt. This can be so useful in a life. And in the same way, with seeing when you're caught in greed, and like with then to take sloth and torpor, when you're trying to make a change, and like some of the people talking with the questions period, like you get a lot of sloth and a lot of torpor will come up around a transition, particularly if you didn't make it, but it was made to you. So a number of people that have had been laid off talk about the amount of sloth and torpor they encounter in their mind and trying to, like, what's next for themselves, that they don't get started, even when they've given themselves a month or 3 months of a rest period, and then say, okay, now I'm going back, and then they start to go back, and then there's just this resistance, this thickness of resistance. Some of you would know that thickness of resistance. And other times it's just like, well, I don't know what happens. I just gone in some way. Just gone. And then the same with restlessness and worry. That you spend your, instead of doing something about the change and transition, instead of responding to it, your mind is so reactive around restlessness and worry that you really kind of spend your thinking about it a lot. But the thinking is not thinking in the way of movement. It's actually this samsaric circle of imagining this going wrong, and then, well, that could go wrong, or maybe I could do this, and maybe I could do that, and you're just going round and round like the hamster on the wheel with our worry, all of which you've been taught before and will hear many, many times again. What is not so usual is to hear this actually being applied to pieces of your life in this kind of arc way. So all the tools come into play. I wanted to read you a poem here. This is captures to my mind the importance of mindfulness when you're confronted with a change in your life, when you're confronted with a transition. It's called Look Around by Mark Nepo. Some of you have heard me read this before. If you try to comprehend air before breathing it, you will die. Yeah, pretty straight on, huh? This is his version of the Buddhist Sutta, when you're the man who's shot by an arrow, who will not let the doctor attend him until he knows what wood this arrow was made of, you know, where did the feathers come from, who actually crafted the arrow, where he wants to know all of this rather than deal with the ailment. If you try to comprehend air before breathing it, you will die. If you try to understand love before being held, you will never feel compassion. If you insist on bringing God to others before opening your very small window of life, you will never have honest friends. If you try to teach before you learn, or leave before you stay, you will lose your ability to try. If you insist on bringing God to others before opening your very small window of life, you will never have honest friends. If you try to teach before you learn, or leave before you stay, you will lose your ability to try. If you try to teach before you learn or leave before you stay, you will lose your ability to try. No matter what anyone promises, to never feel compassion, to never have honest friends, to lose your ability to try, these are desperate ways to die. A dog loves the world through its nose, a fish through its gills, a bat through its deep sense of blindness, an eagle through its glide, and a human spirit, and a human life through its spirit. And a human life through its spirit. So what would be leaving before you stay? What is leaving, and our Dharma understanding, what is it to leave before you stay?
It's not being with the various hindrances that may come up.
So it's not staying with the hindrances, you move on in some way. Okay, thank you.
It could be rejecting something because you think you know what it's about, but having not really heard it new and fresh.
Yeah. Rejecting something because you think you know what it's about, so you didn't really stay present to hear what was being said because you were so busy knowing what was being said. Thank you.
Making assumptions.
Fleeing from suffering. These are all good. Some more? Yes. Wait, I couldn't hear this in the very back.
Talking before listening. You're just seeking judgment.
Judgment.
Going to the interpretive mind.
Going to the interpretation rather than staying with the experience. So I actually think this is a very important thing, this staying. In our Buddhist psychology, the reactive mind starts kicking in so that we don't stay with our experience. We start, our primary experience becomes our reaction to what was the stimulation, what was the experience. So we're reactive to something, and that, so it's, so any experience has pleasant or unpleasant, as you've heard many times, I talked about this last night. The mind becomes reactive to the pleasant or unpleasant in some way that it moves into a grasping or an aversion to it or worrying about it. It's made restless by the experience, or it falls into doubt and so forth. So the mind won't stay with the actual experience. It's therefore very hard to know what your actual relationship is with an experience if you don't hang around long enough to know. So you don't really know what it's like to be in disagreement with your significant other if you don't stay present for what does it actually feel like to be in disagreement with your significant other. You can have been with the person 20 years and always it's been too scary for you, or your anger was so great that you moved away, and on and on and on, that you never actually stayed just to, well, what is this actual experience? Forgetting my reactivity to it. Yes, I have reactivity, but what is the actual experience? What's it like to be disagreed with? What's it like to be falsely accused? What's it like to not to ask and not have a response to what you've asked for? What's it like? Just the actual phenomena of saying, will you? And the answer is no. What is that like? And as we start to face that the changes in our life, we oftentimes don't stay present for the change that's coming up. We leave before we stay. We're off in our reactivity to this change that's impending, that we may have chosen, that we may not have chosen, that may be becoming because of natural things in our bodies or from outside world or wherever the change is coming from. We haven't learned to stay. So when I'm teaching this material in a regular change and transition workshop, one of the things I'm doing is introducing them to mindfulness as a skillful means for being able to stay with their experience. And you've all had the benefit of this sort of thing. So there's big kind of, like just the workshop I was just teaching, this woman came up and said, I love my husband and I love my children, but I have never been comfortable in just being in the relationship with either of them. And I have been a little apart this whole time, and I have never admitted this to myself, let alone someone else. And she said, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to be able to be really present. I don't want to be holding them off. What do I do now? And I actually was just emailed her something last night in the way of something that she was asking for. She had always left before she stayed. You know, she had always left before she stayed. As we go through each period of our life arc, we, in an ideal development way, would be able to stay more and more. So what we couldn't do at 25, we can do at 35. And what we couldn't do at 35, we can do at 45. Because we've been maturing as our life cycles go through their experience, we more and more meet the life cycle. The oldest version that I know of this life cycle would be the Indian version, where you're a kid, and then you're a householder, and then you become a seeker in your old age. This was this is the oldest version of that kind of teaching that I've ever experienced. Why in your older age? Because you fulfilled all of your duties to the culture, but also because you've now learned enough that seeking the one more moment's pleasure through whatever it is, food or sex or glory or power, you know that the marginal value of that next bite of food or that next meal is actually very low. You've been there and done that. And that so in a general way, because of our database, we can look back and see so much. We know more and more that, no, this isn't going to get there. I may not know what will bring more happiness, but what I have isn't going to do it. So there's no reason to keep organizing all my life around whatever that is. That doesn't mean that we give up the things that give us comfort or pleasure, which for many people might be music or food or dance or whatever. It's not that. It's just that the not expecting from these things that give us comfort, not expecting more than that, and then being available for this deeper relationship to ourselves, this deeper understanding to arise. When we treat change and transitions as normal, when we get more curious about them than afraid of them, they become interesting. The exploration of a change in our life, if we cease demanding that we be able to control it, know the outcome of it, or be guaranteed an outcome, then it becomes a time of opportunity for us to drop in deeper, to learn new things about ourselves, to discover more clearly what our core values are. One way that I describe this to myself is the ability to live based on my intention moment to moment, rather than live strictly on my goals. To see that the goals, the worldly goals of all kinds, of very wholesome goals, that's a good allocation of my time is towards the wholesome goals. But that how I really want to live is each moment, each step, the moment of this step towards my goal. And when I'm in a time of change and transition, then I'm interested in each step during this time of transition, how I am present during this step of the transition. So, your mother's dying. And this is a big transition. And let's say your father's has already died, and now your mother's dying, and you're in a transition in your life around being now you're the older generation. This is a very strong psychological thing that many people, when it's happening to them, they don't notice that they're becoming the older generation, and they miss it for some years. Till some point, they actually wake up and they feel it. It's kind of like this happened to them, as opposed to their participating in it. I've gone through this discussion with lots of people through the years. So you feel yourself. Oh, so this is, you feel what you're feeling in terms of your ailing mother, you feel what your mother is feeling. You're open to her transition into death. That this too is a big transition. This is the end of all physicality era for now, no matter what else you believe. For now, it's the end of this physical manifestation. And so you're aware of that. You're interested in that. You're accepting this too as change and transition. You're sad about it, but you're not demanding that it be otherwise, because this is part of life. Life ceasing to exist is part of life, not separate from life. Life would make no sense if there was not an end of life. How would you define life then? It is only being there or not being there. The binary nature of it is how you become aware of it. Otherwise, nothing would bring your attention to it. And so you're interested in this change in terms of your mother. You're interested in this change in terms of yourself as a person, and you're interested in the relationship in this change and transition. Depending on the circumstances of your life, including, you know, your age and all of this, different things will be germane. If you're 15 years old and your mother's dying, that's one thing. If you're 25, if you're 55, how you will relate to this change. Maybe at 55, you've got the time where you can take care of her. But if this happened when you were 25, you could not stop everything and take care of your mother. It wasn't set up that way as it was dying. Or maybe it was. You don't know. But the experience is the experience. My mother dying feels like this to me. You are present for the phenomena of the transition rather than your idea of this is what I'm supposed to do, or what does this mean for me? What is this? Those thoughts will come, but you're grounding yourself in this deeper place. How do I wish to be in this moment? And this moment, and this moment, and this moment of being with my mother who is dying. That is intention, as I would understand it, of the Eightfold Path. It's this moment. It is how you wish to meet life in this moment. In this very moment, what do you bring to your life in this very moment? We are very fortunate to have the Dharma to help us in this process for ourselves. We can start to attend to our wounded egos when we have been laid off, when we are not considered for jobs because of our age, which happens a lot. You might be far more competent, but you won't be considered because you're, quote, too old for that job. And some person's mind. So our egos will, around all changes, our egos are going to have their own challenges. Everybody's ego will be challenged, but in various ways. We're not trying to kill the ego and say the ego shouldn't have its experience, but this knowing it's like this, this mindfulness, is actually larger than the ego and can contain and comfort and steer the ego. Insight wisdom can steer the ego. The ego can be wanting something that insight, that wisdom goes, you know, no, this isn't wise. But the ego really wants it. You've all felt this many times, right? And so the insight that brings this wisdom that can steer the compassion, cares for the ego. Without the compassion, the insight can be dry and brutal and not actually that nourishing. The wisdom can't get into life so easily without this compassion, because you try to slap yourself around. How well has that worked to date? So the two wings of the Dharma that allows the Dharma to fly, compassion and wisdom, they fit together around any kind of a transition in your life. You are aware of the ego's needs, what it would have to do, what it's saying to do, what it's wanting. And then with wisdom, you say yes or no. And with compassion, you are patient. You're patient with the ego. So you could say that the wisdom would give you persistence, and the compassion would give you patience. And you're developing these two critical paramis in any transition. So then the transition becomes this major retreat you're on. You're on a retreat of transition. You're on a retreat of change, and you're just practicing. And then you're back to the change as phenomena rather than your interpretation of the change, your story about the change. The experience of making this change feels like this, and I bring all my wisdom to bear in it. And with that, we will stop for our lunch break, and I will see you back here at 1:45.
What can I have?
Oh, sorry, yes.